Good afternoon to you. You're welcome to Local Media This Week on Scariff Bay Community Radio. My name is Jim Collins and I'm here with my usual two cohorts, John S. Kelly and Pat O'Brien. Gentlemen, good afternoon to you.
And good afternoon to you, Jim.
Good afternoon, Jim.
Our guest this morning, we always have a special guest here on this programme, so a big welcome to one of our own, indeed, from Mount Shannon, Paul Bugler. Paul, good afternoon to you.
Afternoon, Jim. John, Pat.
Paul.
So, we're having a look today, as usual, at the print media in County Clare, maybe a little bit beyond County Clare as well from time to time. And we always urge people here to support our print media because it's so important that we have, you know, a good, vibrant media service here in County Clare. So, I start with John S. John, did you spot anything in your perusing of the papers?
I did. I had indigestion yesterday reading this out of the Irish Times. And I felt, this has got to be discussed. Paul is, and Pat is looking over at me and saying, what's he talking about? You know, but I'm saying, I'm talking about Quilch's warning about the risk to forestry jobs. Now, once the word forestry is mentioned in the national context, Clare ears must open up to it. And East Clare ears, in particular, because of the amount of forestry which we have and which we've been progressing over the last 20 years. And then suddenly, a problem arises. And what the Times was saying was the timber industry is breaking up due to slow appeal system. The chairman of Quilch has made that point. Now, what it boils down to, Paul and Pat and Jim, is that Paul has 100 acres of forestry. He applies for a license to cut. All right. He gets his license, but Pat doesn't like the idea of licences being given to the likes of Paul across the country. So Pat objects, okay? And that goes to the appeals subcommittee set up by the government, right? You'd expect it to be very busy, wouldn't you? But this article in the paper is reporting that out of 382 appeals over the last year, only one of the appeals has been dealt with. And so we're running short of timber supply onto the commercial market. We're sitting in a place which has been surrounded by timber, aren't we? We have floors gone in there last week. It uses timber. But the timber is running out. And why is it running out? Because it can't be knocked. And I'm saying it's time our politicians listened carefully to this one. What do you say, Paul?
Yeah, I think it's a good story. I think it's a great story. It's a bit like the Skibbereen Eagle there, John, in the early 1900s. You're kind of keeping an eye on the Tsars of Russia. Well, it's a national it's a national story at the moment, but it has a very particular significance here in East Clare. I think, if memory serves me correctly, we are either the second or the third on a percentage of land area that has forestry in Ireland. I think we might be just behind Wicklow or possibly just behind Cork, yeah. But we're very high up there. So anything to do with timber or the timber industry is a big issue for Clare and East Clare in particular. Everybody will be familiar with all the movement that you see on the roads. That's a story in itself about the fact that we don't actually process any of the timber here in East Clare. Yeah. We might discuss that another day. But this is an issue that has been kind of boiling away slightly over the last number of months. We had, I think, a new legislative approach to the forestry sector with a new forestry bill a couple of years ago. And part of that bill then introduced what you were talking about there, this appeals procedure. And as listeners will know, and everybody around here knows, we have gone through this before in relation to a lot of infrastructure in Ireland with roads and with bridges and whatever you're having yourself. So it's a kind of a particular way that we tend to do things here in Ireland. We do have this kind of, some people might call it this democratic representational approach to dealing with issues. This one now is starting to play itself out and is becoming, I think, a significant and will be a significant issue if it continues on the road that it's continuing. In that, as you rightly say there, under a previous Forestry Act, I think it was the 1948 Forestry Act, anytime you want to cut a piece of timber or clear fell a forestry or even thin a forestry, you have to apply for a felling licence. So all this has, whether it's a kind of a clear fell for commercial timber to do whatever it is you're doing, like you say, flooring or roofs, or if it's for boxwood or pallet wood to make the pallets that transport our food right around the country, you have to have a felling licence for this. This now seems to be coming to a bit of a logjam. Like you say, 388 applications, one actually dealt with in the appeals procedure. I think it's noticeable even the timber lorries that you do see on the road now, there aren't that many or there aren't as many, and you see a lot of older timber, timber that might have been processed or cut up in the woods maybe 6 months ago or 12 months ago. So you don't see a lot of fresh timber moving now at the moment.
That's very true.
I'm just wondering, like, to take your analogy, John, Paul Bugler owns a piece of timber. It's commercial timber.
Yes.
Paul either bought it as commercial timber or planted it himself, and it's now fit to be harvested.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, like, where can an objection come from? I can understand Paul has to apply for a licence, perhaps, that he's has the wherewithal to actually fell the timber and to bring it safely out. But, I mean, the timber is there to be felled and to be used in industry. So I'm just wondering, where is the, what kind of grounds can one have for objection, other than that Paul isn't competent to do it?
Yeah. Well, it's inbuilt into the actual legislation, isn't it?
It is.
That a person can appeal.
Yeah.
It's a part of the whole democratic process. Isn't that right, Pat?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm.
So, I mean, do you want to stop appealing the appeals process altogether? It's stopped anyway because there's only one handled in the last 12 months. So, by indirections.
Well, my question is, is it the grounds for appeal? Like, you know, Pat O'Brien mightn't have a clue about timber, let's say, or how to do timber, and therefore he hasn't got the experience to fell the timber. Mm. But, I mean, the timber is to be felled anyway. I would say that's possibly taken for granted. So it would be Paul's ability to do it maybe could be a grounds for objection rather than to fell the thing in the first place.
The grounds tend to be environmental concerns. And we can see that. And maybe there is an argument here with this as well, in that we can see, East Clare is a great example of this in the last number of years with the clear felling, which if you go up to Mohara or go up the back of Mount Shannon, Scariff, anywhere there, the amount of timber, or Ogunlough, over Pat's country, anywhere over around there, the amount of timber that has been clear felled has been significant, and that does have it has a notable impact in that the runoff or the amount of water that now comes from the mountains is more significant.
But that's temporary, Paul, because you are obliged, as the feller of the 100 acres that Jim is talking about, you're obliged to actually replant.
But the nature of timber then, John, is that while it's fast growing in Ireland, young trees that are planted won't take up or won't soak up the same amount of water as a mature tree, as a 35 or a 40-year-old tree. So that, I would say, is where a lot of the objections are coming from the environmental aspects. And maybe as a national kind of forestry, it's an important industry, a hugely important industry, and probably an industry we could do a lot more with in Ireland and even in East Clare. Maybe we haven't been dealing with that, the replanting or the kind of the regeneration of part of our forestry land. Maybe we're not up to speed in doing that yet. We're only kind of first generation, I suppose, with a lot of felling.
Don't forget, though, that if you, Paul, having knocked at the 100 acres, get your license, no objection by anybody, you fell your 100 acres, now you have got to replant at your cost. Mm. There isn't any grant.
That's right.
Now,
that's a big issue for farm forests.
Absolutely.
For farm forests, it's a big issue.
So what are we going to say, Pat, to our politicians? Because it's in...
Well, really, I suppose maybe the appeal system needs to be streamlined a bit better. You know, appeals, serial objectors seem to have a lot of power in Ireland. You know, there's various different projects around the country, and serial objectors object, and they seem to have an awful lot of power to stop different projects.
Yeah.
I suppose the time element, you know, and the fee element are two things maybe that, you know, do we have the resources to say, let's say, an objection that goes in must be heard and dealt with within 3 months, you know, and do we have the resources for that? And the other thing then, Pat's talking about the serial objectors, maybe a good refundable fee, but commensurate with the value of the property of the undertaking.
I would agree. There's two elements there. I think number one, and it's a thing, and not just in forestry, but across Ireland, we're very good to produce legislation. We'll produce no end of legislation for you. Mm. But to actually enact the legislation or to make sure that it works properly, we're not very good at that. There seems to be an issue here, from what you've read out there, John, in that the appeals commission or the appeals part of the Forestry Service doesn't seem to be able to cope with that which is being put in front of it. That indicates that there aren't enough people working in that.
Yeah.
So that's your first thing. Sort that out. And number two, Jim, I think you're dead right. And some people might disagree with this, but if you want to object, and nobody is saying that you can't or shouldn't be allowed to object to any infrastructure, any development, but you have to put your money where your mouth is. And if your objection then proves to be successful, well, then your money that you put in with that objection gets
refunded
back to you. And I do think, with respect to this forestry, as you said there, maybe to link it with the tonnage of forestry that's in there or the acreage of forestry that's in there. So we really have to kind of deal with that.
So, I suppose we really have to leave this and move on because there's so much stuff in the media. But we do have a message, you know.
It's something that needs to be addressed.
Absolutely. And I suppose we're talking to our TDs, and we're talking to our senators.
Yeah.
Okay? Mm. And it's something which affects our lives. That's
Well, on that, just to tack on at the end, because it's something I feel strongly about, it was... depressing over the last number of years. I see it going from Mount Shannon towards the Midlands, or I see it going into Ennis, going down onto the motorways.
Yeah.
The amount of timber that has left East Clare that we weren't able to sustain an actual industry here within this area based fundamentally on timber. I think it's every bit as significant as Shannon Airport, the whole timber industry.
That's interesting.
For this part of County Clare. Mm. Or it could be.
Yes. It could, yeah.
Will we come back to this at a future stage?
We will. We'll keep an eye on the...
Oh, we will.
On things.
We hope the media will keep up the pressure.
Yeah.
Just before we go away from it, you'd often see Clearfield where people would say cut down the forestry, and you might see a big area of it. But it might take 5 or 6 years or maybe 7 or 8 years to replant it, to get it going again, which is a big problem as well. Yeah,
that's the architecture. This is maybe to look at slightly the other side of it, how it is that we dealt with forestry, like Pat is saying there now. Have we kind of replanted properly? Have we kind of mounded? Are we doing it the right way to make sure that we haven't got the environmental carnage that some people might say we're actually having there? You know, maybe we're not up to speed. Maybe some of our national organisations are too focused on the commercial side of it, and maybe they're not as responsible towards the environmental side. Now we're starting to, maybe it's an industry that's only starting to learn itself or kind of develop itself. Maybe there's more, but I think Pat could be right on that now as well.
Okay, Jim.
Pat, did you spot anything in the papers this weekend?
Well, we didn't go to our local papers yet, Jim, but I see this here in the...
We're going national.
I see this article in the Irish Independent and the Cotton Eye on Saturday last. It was on the second page of the Irish Independent. And Charlie Weston, he's the personal finance editor, and he said, we are paying 80,000 more than the average mortgage in the Eurozone. Market rates in this country are more than double the average being charged in the Eurozone. It means a new home buyer is paying 80,000 more over the term of a typical mortgage than the average in the currency zone, according to brokers. New figures show that interest rates on home loans here are third highest in the currency zone. Only lenders in Latvia and Greece charge more, according to the central bank. The average rate of a new mortgage was up slightly to 2.82 in July. This is more than double the average for the Eurozone at 1.35. Ireland is the third highest mortgage interest rate across the Euro area in July, the central bank said.
What do you feel about that now, Pat?
So I think that's an annual thing, really. You know, Ireland seems to be charged more all the time. Over the years, like, you always pay more for your mortgage here than you do anywhere else.
Oh, Paul, I tell you, you were in the political world active.
I'm also in the mortgage paying. That's more concern to me.
I mean, it's a reality. What Pat is really yeah. out there, isn't it?
Yeah, it has been. It has been. It's a nice one to bring up here now as well, because it has been consistently and persistently, right, going back to the last financial crisis. We have always been, as Pat says, they're almost double the kind of the euro rate. The only time when people might remember the tracker mortgages that were there was in the last boom area or era before 2008. We kind of linked in with the ECB rate at that point, and that nearly broke all our own banks here. So that tells its own story. What way is it that our banks are actually operating if they can't make money without fleecing customers at double the rate? So it does. But the only way you can deal with that, the only way you can deal with it is through competition. You know, you would think we're part of Europe. We should have a kind of a European perspective on everything. And
were we restricting? So much. Were we restrictive in terms of competition over the decades?
Well, we have seen people have come in. Remember the Royal Bank of Scotland came in there, and they left in a bit of a hurry back in 2009, 2010 as well. So we have had entrance, but it does seem as if at the end of the day you have your kind of major players, Bank of Ireland, AIB, KBC now, and Permanent TSB seem to be the kind of the four major players.
And what about the one that came in last week? Have any of you come across any reference to that?
Is it a Spanish bank? I heard that
at 1.9, is it?
A lot of people are expecting now, aren't they, a fixed rate mortgage war with this new entrant coming in. So they start to flush things out a little bit, maybe.
But all that bank is online. You have to. I heard it yesterday morning in the radio.
Yeah,
and I think it's all online.
But they're open to facilitating you to change.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
Well, why? Here's the second question about that, Jim. How come that young people, they get their mortgage and they're pleased to get it, as far as I read the scene anyway, do you know? They're pleased to get it and sit back then and forget that there is such a thing as a competition.
Because I say when most young people or young couples get a mortgage, they are so delighted to get a mortgage.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, they might see themselves as maybe never being able to get a mortgage or never owning a house, and they progress, and next thing they get a mortgage from the bank, they are thrilled with it. And I agree with you, they probably do forget.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, this is not a banking thing, but back in the early noughties, I remember the Heineken Cup, as it was called then. It was before Munster won. I'd say it was maybe in the first half of the noughties, maybe 2003, 2004, 2005, around there. And the Heineken Cup reached the semi-final stage. And one semi-final was played in the Aviva Stadium, might have been Lansdowne Road then.
Yeah.
And the other semi-final was played somewhere in the south of France. And the ticket price for the Dublin one was double the ticket price for the France for the game played in France.
Yeah.
Doubled the price. Mm. And, I mean, there was a bit of questions asked at the time, like, how come in the same competition, all professional rugby players, one, the Irish one was doubled the other one? And the answer was, the market will take it.
Mm.
The market will take it. So I'm just wondering, would there be a similar thing in relation to the mortgages?
That's not a bad analysis of it. And the market, when you have a closed market as well, if you don't have, or if they make, if the major players in the market keep trying to muscle out anybody who wants to enter the market, well then, I mean, if you can have, you can set the, you know, you can set the actual rates then yourself, or you can set what it is that you're going to make out of it. That's it. Basically, the more competition you can have, the better. And it's good to see somebody coming in now, because the only reason people will come in is if they feel they can make money, here. That's their reason. So obviously that Spanish bank feel they can make money. There are other, Unpost are anxious to enter the mortgage market. But again, as I said, like the forestry, legislatively, it's being made difficult for them to do that. The credit union movement are interested.
Why is it being made difficult?
Because those that are making the most out of it might have the ear of whatever given minister or whatever given government is in place. And they
That's very serious.
It's a political lobbying kind of an issue. Yeah, that's what it is.
Apropos that, because that may be germane. It is germane to what we're talking about. The effect or the impact of lobbying in Ireland, period. I'd say John Citizen doesn't know too much about that. In America, you do know, because it's open.
Okay,
it's a
open,
big professional, type of career in lobbying. Yeah. Big.
Yeah.
Percentages are massive. What do you think?
I thought there was some kind of legislation here in Ireland now about lobbying as well.
I was just, Pat, you're dead right. There has been a new, legislative approach. We have a new set of legislation.
Yeah.
You have to register now as a lobbyist. Yeah. You have to. But then having, and you see, interestingly, take our famous, I don't want to go down this road, our famous golf gate, when you go back and look at that up in Clifton, and you see, that's where a lot of Irish lobbying is done. Not in the official signing the register, but in the gates of Leinster House. It's done at golf tournaments. And if you look at some of the membership at that, it's a great example actually in Clifton, former politicians now working as lobbyists. You know, we're a nice closed little shop.
And he has his
Brian
interest.
Hayes, a former MEP, a former government minister, what's his now job? He's in charge of the Banking Federation of Ireland. So,
this is, are we fingering something kind of important in this question, then, are we? I mean, if, for example, you as a John citizen, okay, is obliged to pay a higher rate of interest on your mortgage because, in fact, in some way or another, we managed to manipulate the actual rules and regulations governing, making it difficult for outside interests to come in.
And the banks, you see, the banks will tell you that a lot of the cause of it is what happened in the last 10 years, of, you know, with the fall in the, and that there's an awful lot of, we'll say, people that weren't able to pay their mortgage, and they're trying to make up their money in that section of it as well, you know.
They will, but a lot of the non-performing loans from that era were sold off then to what we now call the vulture funds. You know, they were taken off the books. The banks were recapitalised by the state. It's a thin excuse. It's an excuse they do make, they will keep making it. But it's a thin kind of an excuse when you actually look at all the things. I think it goes back to Jim's point. It's a simple as that. You can encapsulate it in that it's because the market will take it, you know.
So, and who dictates the market, and what dictates the market? That's the question.
That's the question. That's a good question. That's a it's actually that's I mean, a good question.
We've had
to find an answer is a difficult one.
In raising that whole issue, the second item on our table this morning, okay, and they have direct effect on our economic well-being as a citizen. John citizen. Isn't that right? We're not off key when we say our people who are elected to represent us, it sounds like you can't at this stage, you know, but the people that are elected have got to acquaint themselves with the kind of simple issues like a mortgage cost, like a negative policy with regard to forestation, okay, because that's what it is.
Well, depend on the government, on any government, to lay down the ground rules, to deal with, you know, competition and with a whole range of things, to deal with fairness in the industry, to deal with lobbying. And if the government, you know, if the government apply these rules and police them properly, in theory it should work. But of course, we are such a small country that, I mean, you can go for a game of golf in East Clare Golf Club or, you know, Clifton or wherever, and you know all these people, and you know various people with various competing interests, including politicians, can literally meet together and chat, and that bears out what you're saying.
Yeah, I think it's a big thing. I think it's it's very much an issue in Ireland. I suppose it's a broad it's a political issue anywhere. I saw one yesterday, actually, one of the kind of leading people in the House of Commons from the Labour Party in the last election who stepped down, Tom Watson, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, is now working for Paddy Power, the betting company. And he was vicious in his talking about online gambling when he was in the House of Commons. So it's this, there is, and John talked about it's open in America. This overlap between the political representational democratic system and the business stroke lobbying system on getting things done is getting a bit more blurred, and the political system maybe needs to distance itself a little bit from that kind of thing. I don't know. Politics should be more vocational than anything really, you know. You do your time and then you kind of, you know, you kind of get off the stage sort of a way. I don't know, something like that, maybe.
So if you were a captain of industry, Paul, why would you hire a former politician? What would be the advantages to you, other than the person's ability and genius in terms of business?
That's not necessarily a given in politics. But it's the access. It's the access that a politician gives you then. Mm-hmm. You know, we have political system structures, and it's the same in countries. You know, from county council level to Senate to Oireachtas to European level. And we have a full variety of people engaged, and they represent us, and we elect them. You know,
yeah.
Then, if they come to the conclusion or finish of their career, and somebody, I think there's more of that happening. People are saying, "What that person has learned could be useful to me from a business perspective."
Yeah,
and it's a nice earner for the person.
Great earner then as well.
Yeah, but sometimes you hear cynical comments about the operation of politics in Ireland. You hear that kind of thing. Mm. I suppose it's understandable at times. It may not be true, but it's understandable. But what's coming across to me more and more as I get older, you know, is that there is a massive responsibility on an individual, male or female, who offers herself or himself on the altar of politics. There's a massive responsibility to become informed, to become, you know, like any job, do in service. Where does a politician do his in service? Well, if he's listening here this morning, this is a bit of an in service, isn't it? Right? Okay. But it's a fact. And I mean, and the Greeks, fair play to the Greeks. We go back to the Greeks whenever we kind of raised the question of democracy and over 2,000, 2,500 years ago. Okay. I mean, the Greeks were searching for the ideal system. Okay. But one of the things that struck me about the Greek approach, and I'm talking about BC, do you know, was that Pat is elected by the citizens. And the election takes place in one of those lovely amphitheatres you see in ruins now when you go on your holidays, if you ever manage to get out there again to Greece, you know. And Pat is elected because the citizens feel that he is knowledgeable, you know, honourable. They were always looking for virtue. Whether they got it was another thing, but they looked for it. And if Pat failed in his job as an active politician for the citizens of, say, Athens, at the end of the year, they gathered again for account of your stewardship. We take that out of the testament, you know, the steward giving accounts of his stewardship. Actually, last Sunday, there was one of those in one of the mass readings, those of you who were there will remember. And so if he has failed, out he goes. And if he has failed badly, he's ostracised.
Ostracised, yeah.
Now, when you think about that, the price for failure, okay, was exceptionally high. Now,
yeah,
2,000 years later.
Yeah, we've developed those principles and we're not a million miles from that, you know, with our electoral system. Okay, maybe it's every 5 years, not every 1 year. We might have it every 1 year now, the way things are going, who knows. But we're not a million miles from it. We know it's an idea in evolution. It's taken 3,000 or 4,000 years, but we haven't perfected it yet. Maybe the first thing you said there, John, you know, looking for the perfect system.
Yeah.
I suppose if you kind of accept that you will never have the perfect system, this utopian type system, that might be a good start.
Yes, I agree.
And make the best.
I would agree, yeah. Because the perfect system means no change.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
we do need change. Charlie Watson, Charlie Weston says here about, you know, over a 30-year period, a 300,000 mortgage is costing 80,000.
More than it should be.
Yeah.
Well, it's worth remembering, even though, you know, it's like even with your normal banking, you know, you people now might be on a fixed rate. Fixed rates are relatively, notwithstanding the new entrant, relatively low at this stage, maybe on a fixed rate for a couple of years to keep a close eye. It's not that difficult, actually, you know, to switch or to be able to kind of try and get that little bit in it, but your loan to value might change over the course of your mortgage period. You might get better deals. Don't just stay. Have a good look at it when you come to the end of whatever.
So that's what we're sending out now today, isn't it? Out of that one, Pat.
He says here, switching your mortgage has become a lot easier than in the past. If in doubt, contact your broker who will undertake the work for you. He said, the central bank's retail interest rates statistical release are to show us how huge a drop in the value of mortgage lending in July compared with the same month last year. The volume of new mortgage agreements amounted to 556 million. In July, a fall of 35% in July last year.
There's an issue there. COVID and COVID payments and salaries is a big issue with mortgages and the approval of mortgages now at the moment as well. It is.
Okay, John, when you come down from your dancing around the kitchen table, the studio table, we maybe go back to more local things now.
Well, I suppose Pat or Jim. Nothing could be more local than the proposal to link us into Limerick. Isn't that right? And Fiona McGarry has a nice little article in The Champion about it, reporting on the meeting of the Killaloe Municipal District. Councillor Joe Cooney sought an update on the amenity path, which is to run from Tomgrange to Belkelly, and which will ultimately provide, how about that, greater connectivity between Scariff and Killaloe. Now, Joe Cooney is worried, well, he's not so much worried, but he's concerned a little bit about how what has already been established will be, or if is going to be incorporated into. Are we talking about a greenway, essentially, what Joe's asking there, I think, is he? Yeah. Greenways, we understand a greenway, we have models of it in Ireland.
Mm.
Okay. Very successful, correct? So, Paul, how do you read that?
It's a good article. It always struck me, even we've heard about the Greenway here now for the last couple of months, this linking between UL, the canal, and right up here into Tomgrainy. It's one of those projects, though, or go back to the bit that they're talking about there now. It was fascinating. I don't know how long ago it is now. To see what they actually managed to do in O'Gonelaw that time themselves, with very little
input by outside
support of, input is the wrong thing. That's not what they were looking. But look, what they managed to create, and I've used it. I've actually cycled up and down to Killaloe a couple of times. What the track that they created. Look, it's not your kind of standard, or it's not your state of the art greenway. And we can see that now there with part of the Blue Way that's been developed at the moment.
Yeah.
But it's a bloody credit to them in O'Gonelaw when they actually did that with transport boxes and tractors and loads of 804 and just basically spread it from Belkelly down as far as 2 Mile Gate.
Absolutely.
A bloody great piece of work that was done there. I don't know, it could be 10 years ago now at this stage. So you would have to think that will be incorporated. It's just sitting there waiting to be incorporated into this kind of Rolls-Royce type greenway now at this stage as well. You couldn't see any other option, really. You know, you've got that width all the way down that side of the road down to Killaloe, and then you've got from 2 Mile Gate into Killaloe, you've got the pathway that the County Council did there themselves a couple of years ago. So I would hope, as a testament to the work that the local community in O'Gonelaw did those number of years ago, that could now be incorporated as part of the actual greenway.
And can we, I suppose, alert our listeners this morning to the reality of what the greenway meant to the economic and social life of the Westport Achill Axis.
Yeah.
Do you know? And the Dunn. Have any of you been on any of these greenways?
I've been down in Waterford, John, and the Dungarvan is really buzzing from that walk from Greenway from Dungarvan to Waterford City.
That's good now, because I've done the Achill to Westport one, actually.
Have you?
But we hired out 2 bikes there a number of years ago, put the kids into little trailers when they were younger, and did that from Achill.
Did the whole trip?
Yeah, got a bus out to Achill from Westport and cycled all the way back in over the course of a day, and it was absolutely brilliant. It was fabulous.
And Newport, you see,
Mulroney, all those places, absolutely brilliant.
On your hand, I can immediately, because I know the area very, very well, on my hand, I can see a number of economic spin-offs. You know, the whole bicycle industry in Achill and Westport and Newport and Mulranny.
That's right.
They all have the actual spots. The cafes, the
outside of you, there was one, John, you would might see it unless you're on the Greenway. It was somewhere between kind of Newport and Mulranny, and you were going through a bog, and it had been all done as a Greenway. And at the back of somebody, kind of a very young, you know the land, it's beautiful country, but it's not the easiest land to farm.
Yeah.
Out at the back, basically, the Greenway went at the back of the farm, and they had opened a cafe.
Joseph O'Dolly, an artist.
In the backyard.
I know the guy.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
There's economic benefit.
Absolutely. So local investment. I suppose the message that I take from this is that any investment in a project like a Greenway that does what we think it's going to do, link Limerick with Mount Shannon, okay? Any investment, the spin-off from it will pay back to the state very, very definitely. And it's back to the point you made before about roadways. You know, there are things which we provide infrastructurally which don't of themselves make money, but they cause a spin-off which makes money.
Yeah, we were actually quoting Timmy. He was here one day and he made that point. Like, the road up to my house doesn't make money, but it allows, you know, and you can say the same for Shannon Airport and the various other paths and greenways. Yeah.
There's another little element to this that maybe links back with our first item here. The road network, and some people might be familiar with it, other people maybe not, but the road, and it is open, it's accessible to the people because it's part of their national strategy with Queen's. Yeah. The road network, the internal forestry road network in East Clare, in North East Clare, whether it is Curraghkyle, Turkana, Derrycon, Derryorden, wherever, Ogunlow, is phenomenal. There's as much road inside the forest gates as there is tarmac adam outside. And some of those roads, you know, if you go over to Gunnlow and come over to Cahir Hurley, what they call the Congo, all that type of area, go down to 2 Mile Gate, go up there as you climb by Lussa, you can get all the way back to Bodyke without ever going back onto a road again. You know, and it's the same in Curraghkyle, Turkana, it's Flagmount, Mount Shannon, Whitegate. That network is a huge asset that we haven't even looked at yet. And so the Greenway could be a great way to introduce that road network from a bicycling perspective or from a walking perspective, especially from a bicycling. I do a lot of it myself, the mountain biking up there, and it's just, you wouldn't find a better place to be in those roads.
Well, I have to tell you a good story about one of the areas you mentioned there, above the Congo, as we called it, above it. You can go to Kilbane that way.
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
You can cross it over. But the valley between Kilbane and Cahir Hurley used to be known as Blackguard's Valley. And it presents an opportunity for the walker to experience, you know, why was this place called Blackguard's Valley? Okay. Now, to Sonny Welch took me on a walk through it, God be good to him.
Yeah.
And I was sorry I hadn't recorded it. But he said, John, he said, the Kilbane people, some of them, had a habit of coming across the mountain through this valley, Blackguard's Valley, to avail of the sheep that were grazing around there, okay?
And the Bodyke sheep, is it?
The Bodyke sheep. And he said there was many a fight took place up there. But you see, they had marked out their track from Kilbane, and only they knew it as they went through the muddy and boggy terrain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the RIC chasing after them, okay, could never catch them, okay. So Blackguard's Valley, next time you're up there now, that's a tourist thing,
that's absolutely
a possibility.
That's what I'm saying, that network right around is think it's one of the great jewels of East Clare. We concentrate, and rightly so, we concentrate on the lake and Loch Derg, and it's phenomenal, and all the lakes of East Clare. But that road network through the forestry is seriously good stuff.
I see there, just before you, Pat, I see on page 13 of the Clare Echo, a little report about, maybe none of you have heard of it, a cafe in Tumgraney, a chocolate cafe. John and I were there last Saturday morning, and we had a great morning, calorific morning, probably, but we enjoyed it, no?
Yeah, we did indeed, yeah. We'd recommend it hugely.
Yeah, we would. Pat, sorry, I interrupted you
just
there.
Just as we talked about trails and all, National Bike Week is on next week, from the 19th to the 27th of September. And it's supported by the Clare Sports Partnership and Clare County Council. And I suppose it's promoting cycling really around the country, and you know. So I suppose there's no harm to highlight it.
Yeah. Is there a lot of, I mean, Paul, you mentioned there that you do a bit of cycling. Mm. Are there a lot of people cycling around East Clare?
Absolutely. There's a good group of people. And there's a lot of people actually that use East Clare. The Burren Cycling Club now would use kind of up Killinane and Feakle as a kind of a cycling route on a Sunday. North Tipperary Wheelers, you'd see them going around the lake on a lot of kind of Sundays and Saturdays as well. Limerick Triathlon Club, you'd see them out around the kind of the Bodyke Broadford area a good bit now as well. So there's a lot of people interested in cycling. Definitely a lot of people interested in cycling. And like I say, a lot of that's road cycling, but people don't realise, because you kind of have to really know it. Because you can go into a forest there, and you might know where you finish up sometimes, because you know they're not easily mapped. You just have to let it off and go with it, and hope you come out somewhere, like, you know. But yeah, there's a huge amount.
Yeah, yeah. And I was going there, you know, on a Saturday and a Sunday, you'd have a huge amount of cyclists. You might have 20 or 30 of them in groups coming out from, you know, from Limerick and Innes and out around the area. Yeah.
Do you know what? There's a business. Gerard Tracy tells me that one of his difficulties, the demand for his services is very, very high. But one of the difficulties he has is actually sourcing, especially in the COVID problem.
Sourcing parts. Even parts or bicycles. For a while there, August is always a month where you get a lot of people changing their bicycles and new ranges come out and things like that. It was very difficult this year to actually, you know, to buy a bike. There were a lot of bikes snapped up when people were kind of locked down. A lot of bikes and a lot of accessories purchased. It was the more so than the timber earlier on. There was an issue there in relation to kind of cycling and supporting your cycling.
Are bicycles expensive, Paul? What be the average price for a bike now?
It depends who you're talking to. We see there is the cycle to work scheme as well, and I think that has been expanded. You can claim back tax up to, if you spend up to €1,000, and depending on the rate of tax you're on, you can claim back a certain amount of that.
Would €500 buy you any sort of bike?
€500 would buy you a good bike. That would buy you a good decent bike now. It would, but like anything, because of the demand and the market will take it.
Yes,
it's quite notable that the prices are starting to increase this year because there's more of a demand. That's quite notable. Notable, actually, with bicycles.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just looking there on the East Clare page, and this is over Pat's Country, although the 12 o'clock hills are probably between Kilkish, or between the mills and Oldfield, Pat. Yeah. But Oldfield Barn Church, restored to its former glory.
Yeah.
And it's a story there that I know our correspondent in Oldfield, and we have a correspondent in Oldfield, Michael Tynan, talked to us about some time ago, that the original altar in Oldfield had been removed in the 1960s, but it's a local man was making a replica of it. Obviously, a local craftsman was making a replica of it. And I see there they had the bishop out to bless it.
We've been there before, Bishop. We did a live broadcast from... Most pleasant day.
It was a fabulous morning. Yeah, yeah, it was really. We did a live broadcast from Oldfield Church.
Did you ever see it, Paul? It's a barn church.
I know the church, yeah. But it's actually, you talked there, and I'm not to get away from it, but I just visited the 12 o'clock hills, been listening to a lot in the last couple of weeks. That, no more so than you're talking there about Blackguards Valley.
Yeah.
That was a wonderful afternoon to take the walk there. But the best thing, I'd say, to attribute to the people involved in it, the little plaques in relation to the people that lived up on the mountain and the locations and maybe things like the stepping stones. I thought that was absolutely brilliant. I thought it just kept their memory alive. You could only see maybe the ruins of the little houses. It was just fabulous to see that level of thought put into their locality and their area.
But the names of the people.
The names of the people and who they married.
Oh, brilliant.
And what they worked at and all.
Fascinating. Yeah. It was great. It was really good. Yeah. It was great little touch.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Oldfield
Church, again, an iconic building over there, Pat, in that area, isn't it?
Oh, T-Church, it's very old. It goes back to the 1600s, really. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, in the Great Wind, there was an attached roof in it, and in the 6th of January, 1839, The big wind took the roof.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was re-roofed in, and it started off as a shed for corn, really. And in the penal times, they started saying mess there, like the mess rocks, you know. Mm. It was a kind of a hiding place for priests, you know. So it went from there, and I suppose it developed as a church all along the way.
And I know our man there, Michael Tynan, he's often talking about it and the history of it, but I mean, at one stage it was under threat from the diocese, as in to be closed down.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the best thing that ever happened. Yeah. You know, because
they all came together.
It really brought, and it's. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's very little else we'll say that somebody outside would find interesting, let's say, in Orfield. But by God, are they passionate about their church?
Well, I think the parish. Do you remember we talked about Kilkishan, the emergence of the Kilkishan church? Okay, we were discussing when we were in Oatfield that day. We were discussing the origin of the Barn Church, the Barn Chapels, like the one down in Cratlow as well. And we were talking about the Kilkishan church, and I don't know why this is brought to mind, but. When the church, the original church in Kilkishan was built, okay, what you're looking at today is a replacement, but there weren't any seats. So the strong, we'll call them the strong families of the area, had their own seats made and positioned them where? In the front row, okay? So now you can visualise the two classes of people in the packed to the very small church or chapel, and this family shall be nameless, okay, had their two rows of timber seats up at the front, but it was a cause de guerre, because the end result was the following Sunday these seats were fonged out, and there was a to-do outside the gate, but there wasn't any gate outside the chapel, and one guy was killed in the fracas. So that's passion in the pursuit of religious endeavour.
Pat, you had another piece of music for us. Do you want to...
We go from that, yeah, I know Donald Lyon well. I worked with him actually in Shenley Airport. Donald is a very nice fellow. And
it was he who made the altar.
He made the altar.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So,
that intrigued me. No, I haven't read the paper yet. What happened to the original altar? Do they know? I can't remember.
I know Michael was here talking about it because he gives us reports regularly from there, and he was talking about what the altar, but I just can't remember what happened.
No, it doesn't say here now.
Pat, were you aware of the fact that the altar in Tumgrinny was made by Porrick Pierce's father? They were altar makers.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a nice piece of information.
But I suppose on the altar in the 1960s, there wouldn't be the same attitude towards preserving things from the past than there would be now.
Right.
You know, and I suppose the community there hadn't galvanised at the time, and maybe this thing was seen as a relic.
Get rid of it.
Yeah. The church is one of the only three surviving Bairn churches in Ireland, which dates back to the 17th century.
Mm. Yeah. Okay.
Mm. And it's believed to be one of the best preserved and still in regular use by members of the local community, and particularly popular as a wedding venue now.
Lovely. Okay, Pat, you had another piece of music, you said.
I think we might go to Scotland now this time.
We've left Wales behind. We have
the flower of Scotland.
Oh, lovely.
Lovely, okay.
There's one.
Yeah.
Right, the Flower of Scotland, and absolutely fabulous music there. In line, I suppose, with the Welsh one that we had early on.
Absolutely.
But John Kelly again in great form.
That wasn't my voice.
Waving his arms. Okay, Aer Lingus pseudo flights at Shannon.
What's that, Jim?
Says Crow. Yeah, it's apparently, according to Councillor Crow, I was going to say, Cathal Crow TD, flights which are available, seemingly, from Shannon. So you go along and you want to fly somewhere.
Yeah.
You book your flight, you pay your money, and then the flight gets cancelled prior to flight. And according to this article here, you have to wait months and months, 4 or 5 months, to get a refund.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Mm. I heard that story during the week. It sounded peculiar that Aer Lingus would feel the need to, you know, basically about getting cash into your balance sheet to make your accounts look better, and that you can hold on to that then for a number of months before you refund it. I couldn't understand that you would actually make a huge amount of money out of that. I think that's the point Cathal Crow was trying to make.
It was highlighted there for the last few weeks about what was happening, but I think they were probably testing the market to see would they be able to get loads.
What kind of, maybe that was another strand to it.
Apart from
what
it says,
what kind of demand is there out of Shannon? Then they can come then and say, well, no, there's X demand, even though everybody down there is saying that there's X plus Y demand or whatever. Maybe that. But the idea that they'd be taking the money off you and holding it for 6 months to make their own balance sheet or profit and loss account look better seems.
Well, for a company the size of Aer Lingus,
seems a bit.
It does. But that's the report anyway. Yeah. Anything
and
else?
I mean, stay on Shannon. The independent TDs band together on Shannon Troubles. That's on this week's Champion as well. That's a new one. These are the independent TDs across the west of Ireland.
Yes, and from Donegal down to Kerry.
Yeah, and acting collectively. I mean, are the independents being forced into nearly a party?
You're on this issue.
Yeah.
It looks like there could be some kind of a coordinated effort being made on that anyway. So, you know, any kind of coordination on that one is welcome.
Yeah, but we're waiting. Every week now, Paul, we have raised the question of the Shannon.
Mm.
And we're saying, again today, that we can identify what the problem is, but we haven't succeeded in giving any suggestions as to the solving of it.
I think it's going to be a very difficult one, and it's only going to be more problems, I think, created. I think the most fundamental problem is our infrastructural network in the country anyway.
Yeah.
You know, our road network that we developed, our access to Dublin, potentially our access to Cork, that's always going to put significant and huge pressure on Shannon. The model that we're going to have there, even the model for air traffic in the future, vis-a-vis coronavirus, could be totally different. The amount of travel that we do, you talked about if we ever get to Greece again, John, there, you know, air travel, international air travel may not be what it has been heretofore. Travel to the US may not be what it is. It's going to be a very, very, very tough time for Shannon. Mm. It's going to be a very tough time for Shannon.
So therefore a very tough time for politicians, because they tend to be, people have expectations.
Well, this is it.
Isn't that right?
That's the thing.
Sometimes unreal.
Mm. Well, in line with that there as well, save our Shannon calls from action over Aer Lingus fields. The Save Our Shannon campaign is calling the Irish government to repurchase Aer Lingus. 5 years ago, the state sold the last of its remaining shares in Aer Lingus, which has been a subsidy of International Airlines Group. Aer Lingus has long operated key services from Shannon to Heathrow in America. However, the Heathrow service is currently suspended, and there are fears of the transatlantic service to be removed also. I think we talked about that last week.
We're running out of time, lads.
We have one more thing, John, to talk about.
And we can't spend any time really talking about it except to bring it to your attention. And that is, this week, the papers in Clare have numerous references to commemoration. 1920, 1921. Okay. No less than the Scariff situation. The Scariff barracks. They came in for a bit of a thundering 100 years ago. And also, of course, the four martyrs on the bridge in Killaloe. And then there's, you have one there, Pat.
And Fecal as well.
And Fecal. Yeah. Fecal. So all we can do is recommend to you, since we're running out of time, that. You buy the Champion and the other papers support, as you said, Pat, local media. And,
okay.
And read the stories there.
You've also, John Dale, there's a full page on West Clare, and it's that's a very right. famous yeah. one back to Rhineen and between Milton and
Lahinch. We might come, we might come back to the commemorations next week.
It'd be nice to have a discussion on it. Yeah.
We'll have to leave it there, folks. We're out of time. Our thanks very much to John S. and to Pat for being here again this week. Special thanks to Paul, our guest this week. Great seeing you back in the studio. Yeah,
great to be back.
And that's it for now. Go out and support your local papers. You've been listening to Local Media This Week on Scariff Bay Community Radio.